I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and irregular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an irregular warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency, and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together. Hello, and welcome to episode 050 of Chasing Ghost in a Regular Warfare podcast, Storming America, TTP to Make You Free, Part 2. TTP is Tactics, Techniques, and Procedures for all of you former military folk out there. Episode 50, can you believe it? We've arrived. So this is sort of like a touchstone for me because I didn't know I'd get to this point, but we have. With rarely a falter or stumble in the fortnightly cadence, the issuance every 2 weeks of a podcast episode, things have gone well. I am forever grateful to my listeners and those interlocutors who I speak to on my Substack, or they reach out to me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. A little bit of housekeeping. I wanted to draw your attention to the 4 or 5 daily blog entries I make at the Libertarian Institute, where I am the Smedley D. Butler Fellow for Military Affairs. And I take a rhetorical chainsaw, as it were, to the military establishment in the U.S. primarily and throughout the West when I get the opportunity to show that when it comes to the future of warfare, whether it is developing countries, third world, or peer contest or near-peer contest in the future, whatever that may be, that the U.S. will find that it's very shiny and flawless record of stalemate and defeat since 1945 will probably remain in place. People are always asking me what I'm reading. What I've read of late has been William Trotter's book called Frozen Hell on the Finnish campaign by the Soviets, 1939 to 1940, and this plucky little tiny nation besting this war machine gargantuan behemoth of the USSR at the time during nearly 110 days of conflict. I recommend it to everybody. And also, I don't simply read military. Sometimes I read other stuff. For instance, I'm reading Quantum Man about one of my favorite physicists, a very funny and intelligent gentleman by the name of Richard Feynman, who has passed. But I find that I think it was 19, and I'll put this in the show notes, I think it was 1974 Caltech, he gave the speech to the graduating class on the cargo cult of scientism. And I find that I am always going back to that brilliant rhetorical slashing and fencing exercise that he did, calling out the people who say they're practicing science, but they aren't. And of course, I occupy myself with some fun reading on occasion from the Congressional Research Service and the Government Accountability Office, who I have found when it comes to giving the data-driven ground truth on what has gone awry and what's going wrong with the Pentagon and their exquisite platforms and weapon systems, I am always using those for the most part as the touchstone for my blog entries, where I tackle a lot of naval history, what's going on with the Navy. Well, actually, I cover it all. I cover the Air Force, the Army, Uncle Sam's Misguided Children, the whole works. So if you get a chance to visit, do so. Now, this episode, 050, Storming America, TTP to Make You Free, Part 2, I was planning on doing cellular biology, guerrilla organizations, and talking about cell structures and what makes guerrilla organizations effective by adopting that methodology of organizing in contested and non-permissive environments. But that is going to be episode 051, because by popular acclaim and request, readers, listeners, and other folks have either written in or contacted me in some fashion, said, can you flesh out more stuff for your Storming America TTP? And that's what I'm going to do. So in my first episode that I did 2 weeks ago on this very thing, I talked about at the personal level for friends, family, and neighbors, what you can do to prepare for what I have warned everybody who will listen about when it comes to this when, not if, of an apocalyptic attack on America proper, which I do think is going to happen. It's a morbid forecast that I wish would never avail itself in reality, but I suspect it will more and more. When I see what's happening in Ireland, for instance, in the UK, for instance, and I see what immigration has done there, in this case, not the kind of targeted immigration bringing in folks who will be a positive benefit to civilization as a whole, whatever that country is practicing. But they're not asylum seekers, but maybe folks who are on H-1B visas, who are providing the STEM, the science, technology, engineering, and math help and assistance that is so needed in the West right now to keep our civilizational construct aloft, since it all depends on technology. And what we're all witnessing right now is what I would consider to be a chaos avalanche. This cavalcade of calamities that is the incompetence and the misinformation and the hiring of people who have no business doing what they're doing. Everything from architects to bridge builders to engineers to traffic signal technicians to booking flights on aircraft, flying on these aircraft, and everything in between. We are suffering what I consider to be an existential crisis that will not get better with age and will simply worsen, hence the phraseology of chaos avalanche. Boeing, of course, is a great exemplar of what's going on, because here we have the Boeing space station visit by the Boeing spacecraft that cost twice as much, of course, as the SpaceX offering that was initially an eight-day trip, but may have the two-man crew of astronauts who went up to the International Space Station remaining through, wait for it, 2025, as a result of sending a spacecraft up that not only had a lot of really idiotic features to it, but just so happens to be one that cannot be undocked remotely, but must have a human being inside to undock it. Now, all of that is possible, but that human being would have to undock and then EVA back to the space station from a smaller object, EVA, to a larger object, EVA. Now, I'm something of a student of space activities worldwide, mostly in the West, but I do have a fair bit of knowledge when it comes to Soviet and Russian exploits in space, since they had so many firsts when the space race started in the 1950s, is that when it comes to docking, which is three-dimensional chess and very difficult, I am not certain, and I would love to be corrected by my listeners and readers, I am not certain if an EVA has been conducted from a smaller object that would be left abandoned to a larger object. I'm very used to seeing EVAs occurring from larger objects. Maybe Space Shuttle Bay opens, and then an EVA is conducted, and it's an extra vehicular activity for an astronaut that's usually lanyarded in one fashion or another to the larger craft so that they don't drift away, as it were. Now, so I'm not familiar if this has been done. If it has, please let me know. I will make sure that whatever I have this penchant for saying, hey, read this book or look at this study, things like that. I'll try to do my very best to put that in the show notes. If listeners take a listen to this podcast and you find that I've neglected something that I mentioned to put in the show notes, let me know and I will make sure that I amend that for you. So with no further ado, let's get on with this episode, which is episode 050. Can you believe it? Storming America, TTP to Make You Free, part two. So in part one, I discussed, for the most part, and by the way, a very short reminder, why am I concerned with Storming America? Why am I concerned with TTP? We're going to revisit very quickly for those of you who may be brand new listeners. But starting episode 37, I did a four-part series on Storming America, where I took the October 7th, 2023 attack from Gaza into Israel proper, and I upsized that with the aid of a lot of people who are much smarter than I am, in this instance, William Fortune and Kurt Schlichter. You can look at the show notes for how to get those books, and others who I talked about and quoted, where what happens if you upsize that attack, and for easy math, and I'm not going to do math on air, don't worry, 10,000 folks 10,000 cell members attack America simultaneously on the same day. Could be Tuesday morning at 0800 East Coast time, whatever the case may be. And they launch this simultaneous attack. It will be a disaster because we are not set up to receive the attack. We are not set up to protect ourselves from the attack. And all I'm trying to do in what was the previous podcast, which was going to be a solitary podcast, and now it's been expanded in two parts, this being part two, is provide you with some of my insight into what I consider would be great ways for you to protect yourself and to be prepared and to get in the training and preparation mindset of, if you're in the thick of it, what to do as a result of meticulous planning, because a large part of good luck is meticulous planning. So I talked about weapons. I talked about rifles, pistols. I don't talk very much at all about shotguns because I think I'm one of the few in the gun world who just doesn't pay a lot of attention to that weapon system, because when it comes to owning a Krag Jorgensen from the late 19th century and using that in the 21st century with all the technology that I have available, I do not want to employ a weapon system in which I have to load it up one round at a time, excepting those magazine-fed shotguns that are out there that aren't ubiquitous as the other ones are. Whether it's a pump or an auto, you're still pumping rounds into it one round at a time. Doesn't make sense to me when I have access to these exquisite weapons, like for a pistol, for me would be the Glock. If you choose to use a 1911 or a Turkish pistol or a Russian pistol, whatever it is you're good at using as your pistol, for me it's the Glock. It always has been among my friends and family and associates. It is the village pistol. If you differ with that and you're a champion of HK, whatever the case may be, go with the gods. Odin smiles upon you and get good with that weapon system. Great. As far as rifles are concerned, I really like the AR Stoner platform. I think until I get that 40-watt plasma rifle that Arnold Schwarzenegger told us about in the 1980s, this is going to be the one that's going to satisfy my rifle needs in semi-automatic rifle. Now, as far as bolt guns, love the Sakos, which are Finnish. I love the Remington 700. Winchester can be a bit finicky, depending on which one you get. A pre-64 is preferable. But as far as bolt guns for the larger calibers, I do have an AR-10 that fires 308. But when it comes to anything above 308, you probably want a bolt gun. And with a bolt gun, you want proper optics. Now, revisit the previous episode where I talked about all of that, because I don't want to crowd out this episode talking about those very things. But that's sort of like for people who may not have taken the time to listen to the previous one or are listening to this one. So what I wanted to cover today were a few more addenda items for how you can protect yourself. So in the previous one, I talked about weapon systems. I talked about the importance of training, whether it's dry fire or paying for proper training at a range with people who know what they're about with rifle and pistol. It's the best money you will ever spend, besides quality optics, to which you should break the bank if you can to make sure you get it, because those can be put on all weapon systems. I just got a new 507K in from Holosun and put it on my Glock 43X. That was yesterday, put it on, and that was... I keep on improving my position, keep on improving fighting position, keep on improving the tools that I have to protect my family, because as a husband and father, I have two primary roles. I am provisioner and protector. And I take that really seriously. I think once you provision that stuff, one of the essential things that you really need to consider is body armor. I know that sounds a bit shocking because you're not in the military or you're not law enforcement. Why would you need that? Well, because we live in a violent world, and body armor is one of the, I would say, markedly different things that we have for militaries worldwide since the end of the 20th century and really revved up at the beginning of the 21st century, where you had this very curious thing happen, for instance, in the Afghanistan and Iraqi wars, and to a lesser extent, this occurred in the other wars in Libya, Syria, and the Horn of Africa and such. This wearing a body armor aligned with what's called, in military argo, TCCC, which is Tactical Combat Casualty Care. At the beginning of the 21st century, with the combination of body armor and being able to achieve that golden hour of casualty care where you're getting somebody not only that immediate paramedic response when you are shot or you're in an IED, whatever the case may be, but you're probably going to find yourself in the appropriately leveled casualty care medical facility for trauma life support that will help you out. Now, among those things are tourniquets, which we're going to discuss a little bit later, and things like that. But this combination of tourniquets, a real serious bent towards being competent in TCCC at the lowest level, that is tactical combat casualty care, it's a tremendous force multiplier in keeping people alive. So why can't, as Lewis Botkin at T-Rex tells us, why can't the civilian defense industry leverage a lot of that and employ it here? So I would say, stealing from Lucas, is that this civilian defense industry in which we have to protect ourselves, because the cops certainly aren't going to be there, practically speaking and morally speaking, when these things occur, nor, as the Supreme Court has told us in three separate occasions, do the cops have an obligation to protect you as an individual in society for obvious reasons and other reasons. So if you are able at the margin to increase your ability to protect yourself by wearing armor and also protect yourself by having IFACs, individual first aid kits, and gun trauma kits and things like that, you are going to make it so that if you do take a round or you're hit or you're stabbed or something like that, you have everything on you. You may have access through phone trees that you've developed or whatever it is in your community of neighbors and friends and colleagues that you put together so that if something like this happens, you have access to the care that you need. So when it comes to body armor, for the longest time until 2024, the DOJ, the Department of Justice, had standards. Well, those standards just so happened to have changed in April 2024. Now, with using, and I'll put this in the show notes, NIJ standard 0101.07 in conjunction with 0123.00 has sort of changed the categorization, but the categorization roughly remains the same, but they've made some gradations and granularity in the way they address breaking down what they can stop and what they can't stop. Roughly speaking, level 2 will stop 9mm and 357 mag. Level 3 alpha will stop 357 SIG, 44 mag, and 12 gauge. Level 3 will stop 7.62 by 5.1 M80. And level 3 plus will stop 7.62 by 3.9, which is a Kalashnikov round, and the 5.56 M183. What you find is that that distinction between level 3 plus and level 4 for the 5.56 in particular is going to be one that is granular but important. Level 4, of course, will stop 5.56 M855, which is 62 grain, and 30-06 M2AP. That M2AP, that 30-06 round, is what you would find in the 1903, 1917, and Garand models of rifle that were in the military, still popular. By the way, if you do happen to have a Garand, and if you don't, you should be ashamed of yourself. Make sure that you do not employ hunting cartridges of 30-06 in there, because the chamber pressure was only designed to sustain this chamber pressure of 150 grains and below. If there's stuff here that I'm talking about, which appears to be a foreign language, because of the brevity and length limitations that I have on these podcasts, I would urge you to either write to me for better amplification and elucidation on what those things mean, or look at the literally hundreds, if not thousands, of written and video resources that talk about these very things to a degree that I don't have the time to tackle in this podcast. So for me and our family, we try to use level 4 plates if possible. Here's one thing that you'll find. When it comes to level 4 plates, weight is everything. For instance, well, this is also addressed by level 3, level 3 plus, and all of these. Weight is the critical factor here. When I first deployed to Afghanistan, and I purchased my own armor when I went over there to include purchasing my own helmet and such, I wanted to take advantage of the technology that was out there. So not only did I get the soft Kevlar in my Velocity Systems armor vest that I was wearing, but I also got a level 4 plate that was rather, for the time, not as heavy as others. But now the technology with the synthetics away from the metal and things like that has gotten so that they're really, and I wear a large. I could wear a medium, but I'd rather wear a large because with a swimmer cut. And if you don't know the distinction between shooter cut, swimmer cut, and non-cut, I would urge you guys to look that up. What it all comes down to is framing a profile that is reduced to make movement easier. So for me, I tended to wear a swimmer cut level 4. At the time, it was 7 pounds. But now I can purchase a level 4 that's 5 pounds and under. And I know 2 pounds doesn't sound like a lot, but the soldier's load since Roman times has been at between, I won't use kilograms, has been at between 50 to 110 pounds. Emergency approach loads for 11 Bravo and 0311 soldiers in the Army and Marine Corps, respectively, even today approach 140 pounds. And all you're doing is looking at your feet if you're carrying 140 pounds on your back. But nonetheless, when I say 140 pounds, that's your combined weight of your rucksack, your weapon, your magazines, everything that you're wearing, where you're naked, you step on a scale, and then you go to war, and you've got this extended, this emergency approach load, step on the scale. If it's 140 pounds, you're going to be lucky. If you're a mortarman, it's probably going to be more than that. If you're stepping on board an aircraft to do a mass tack or even a ramp exit with an SF team or something like that, you may even exceed that with your parachute equipment. But a lot of that isn't relevant for you as civilians. To me, body armor at the margin is a huge advantage that U.S. citizens have that they need to leverage and take advantage of. I urge all of you to get smart about it. I urge all of you to get the highest level of penetration protection that you can. In my case, I try to have level 4 for everything. Level 3 plus is something that I have for several of my vests, but for the most part, I try to stick with level 4. I urge you to research this, and your mileage may vary on what you get. And as I've mentioned in several podcasts, we all have our holster box of woe, which is those holsters that we have purchased, for instance, where we found, man, it looked great online or in the catalog. I ordered it, and it simply doesn't work for me, so it goes in that box to be given away, or you find a new recipient, whatever the case may be. I'm warning you, the same thing will happen with body armor. Now, there are two ways to wear body armor. You can wear it discreet, or you can wear it outright, which is going to be non-discreet, where you've got a plate carrier. I urge you all to look at plate carriers and see what you like. Do you want monocolors? Do you want multicam? Do you want a camouflage that is particular to the area that you may live? Because if you're in Hawaii, Alaska, or the Northern CONUS, or you're in the area of the country that I'm in the Southeast, those camouflage requirements are going to be quite different. My camouflage requirement is going to be what I call Michael Collins wear. When Michael Collins went to war against the UK, and we have talked about him in my podcast, when he went to war with the UK, it was a suit and tie war. Men wore their hats, their suits, their ties, carried their weapons, whether they were rifles or pistols, and that's how they went to war. I suspect that we're not going to have a lot of people in America, even if this terrible thing happens that I keep talking about, this simultaneous eruption of violence by bad actors from overseas who have found themselves in America and their cell is activated one Tuesday morning. You're not going to find yourself in a good position if you've got to get in uniform or whatever the case may be, whatever you think is appropriate, but you're probably going to be going to that particular conflict and engaged in it in whatever you're wearing to work that day or something like that, if you want military uniforms and things like that. And by the way, don't associate mil-spec with quality. Those who have been in the military know exactly what I'm talking about. Those who have not been in the military, you're in for a big surprise if you do equate mil-spec with quality. Are there camouflage patterns that you want? Sure, go ahead and see what you like. I happen to be very attuned, and I really like the dark nutria colors that the South African Armed Forces used as a proud African American. South African Armed Forces used in the 1970s and 80s. And I think monocolor is the key. I happen to love a lot of my kit, not in black, which was popular for the longest time, but in flat dark earth and that khaki color, that sort of light brown color that you see, because it doesn't look as dirty. I found with all black kit, for the most part, you could set it down in a pristine room, come back 5 minutes later, it's going to look dirty. FDE sort of protects you from that. So I would urge you to do your own research online and see and look at armor and see what you like. And I'm here to tell you, you should practice, because you'll find that that difference of 2 or 3 pounds between those 8 pound level 4 plates and the 5 pound level 4 plates, when you're doing it all day, is the difference between night and day. So I'd urge you to get smart about that. When it comes to helmets, I keep a workplace helmet in my office along with orange vests for obvious reasons. Now, when it comes to military helmets, I think one should consider having that in your home, in your equipment, because it has 3-alpha stopping power, which is that it's going to stop a 44 mag or a 12 gauge, or at least it's going to stop the accelerated tunneling of the other cartridges on your noggin. The other reason that I recommend having a helmet, and I recommend the ACH or the Mitch, I'm really fond of the Mitch. I've owned OpsCore. Those are the sexy cuts that you see on television in which your ears are totally exposed. I like those. Those are okay. Super spendy. And there are great places to get helmets, but you want to make sure, if you buy a helmet, make sure you're not buying Chinesium, which is, man, if that helmet price, and this goes with everything when it comes to the things that I'm going to discuss today, if that helmet price seems to be too good to be true, it probably is. If you want a proper 3-alpha helmet, that's a Mitch or a modified ACH, whatever the case may be, then what you're going to do is you're going to shop around and you're looking at $600 plus for a proper helmet. For a proper harness system in the helmet, I'm very partial to Uncle Sam's Misguided Children and what they have as a harness system. But there are also aftermarket manufacturers like Wendy's and others who make terrific interior helmet accoutrement that makes them much more comfortable to wear and to keep them on your noggin. Now, what's another reason why I think it's necessary for civilians to own helmets? Because where else are you going to put your NVGs, your night vision goggles? Where are you going? Now, there are skull caps you can get out there on which you could put them. And you may ask yourself, well, Bill, why do I need NVGs? Because NVGs, for the most part, when we look at military scraps in the latter part of the 20th century and certainly at the beginning of the 21st century, what has given the edge to Western forces, primarily the U.S., is the ability to fight at night. And for those of you, again, I'm going to refer to movies, and my milfolk here will find other ways to see the illustrations for this. We all see those movies where it's grainy green through the NVGs. It's a single nod like a PVS-14 over the left or right eye, or it's binocular where it's over both the left and right eye, or it's the $45,000 quads that you see on the SEALs and such, again, in movies and television series. They're great. Your budget is going to determine what you want, what you'll discover with NVGs, and once you have them, you'll wonder, why didn't I have these before? It makes a tremendous difference in two ways. Number one, it allows you to double the time effectively, except for my Alaska listeners, because you guys have daylight and night issues. We don't suffer down here in the lower 48. It allows you to double your operational time, and it also gives you the ability to retreat, if you have to, in a fashion where you don't have to illuminate who you are, where you're going, as long as your opponents don't have night vision capability either. I'm really partial to the steel industries folks right here in my own state of Florida near Tampa, where when I bought my PVS-14s from them, which are just tremendous, and these are white phosphor film. The clarity is just bloody amazing, and I was able to go there, and I got in the dark room with one of their engineers. He had 4 available ones for me to test out. I did test out the one that was optimized for my eyesight, and I paid for it. Mind you, I've mentioned the price for helmets, $600 plus for decent helmets. You can, by the way, when I talked about the other kit, whether it's monocolor, multicam, whatever you get as far as uniforms, boots, things like that, there's all kinds of stuff on the market across the board to include the used market. Now, when it comes to this, you're going to pay about $4,000 for your J-arm, which conjoins to the helmet mount. That's going to be about $200. And then for the actual mount itself that mates to the helmet, you're looking at around $400. You're looking at $5,000 roughly for what I consider a basic top quality single NVG optic PVS-14, which means it's not binocular. Only have one over a left eye or right eye. You choose which one that you're going to employ. Moving on to other things, go bags are very important. Again, I'm speaking to you here on a podcast in which I have a limited amount of time, but if all I'm doing is tickling your fancy by saying start investigating this stuff, there is under the tip of this iceberg that I'm introducing you to here, whatever you find interesting, which would be optics or NVGs or uniforms or helmet dynamics or things like that, you can find there's a whole host of stuff at bookstores or online in videos and articles and such. Garantham, really enjoy his videos. You can go there and there's a huge library of ways you can optimize what your purchase is going to be. So I'm going to talk about two go bags. A go bag is simply something that you put in your car, or maybe it's at your home. And wherever it may be placed will determine just how large it is. The other thing I would recommend is what we adopted in the military, which was an individual first aid kit. And what it basically is a gunshot trauma kit. And a gunshot trauma kit, and I think that if you carry a pistol EDC, everyday carry, every day, wherever you go, and I do, even in the home, I wear one, I have a TQ, I have a tourniquet. And my youngest son, he goes to a Stop the Bleed course on occasion. He is a certified combat medic, and he did some of the other courses there. He has guided me in some of the things I need, but the minimum thing you need if you carry a pistol to be a responsible defensive pistol person out in the wild is you need to have a tourniquet or two. I recommend North American Rescue because there's a lot of Chinese garbage out there. So, again, if you're paying too little for it, you should question that and see if you're actually getting the quality item that you need. Something I always like to say, which is that if you have a $10 head, you have a $10 helmet. When it comes to IFACs, individual first aid kits, and gunshot trauma kits, make sure that you have yours on your person, in your car, at your home. Make sure you have what you need to do so. When I was active duty and when I was contracting, I carried a minimum of 4 TQs on me, and I carried them in a bilateral fashion, in which if my left or right side of my body or limbs were injured, I could reach with the opposite one to the other side of my center line to get it. Your mileage may vary on what you want to do. I carry a single TQ now. I recommend that you have other ones available. And along with the TQ, and you can custom make these things for yourself, what I would recommend that you have is that you have the tourniquet, two chest seals, a compression gauze, a 4-inch bandage, first aid blanket, those are those reflective ones that you see, medical shears, protective gloves, eye shield, but your eyeglasses will do if you wear them, and a combat cravat, which is for neck injuries and such. I also recommend blood clotting granule applicators like Celox and stuff like that. This is stuff that you can sort of... One has seen movies where they would put sulfa on wounds in World War II. This is same thing is done in application, but the technology has accelerated well beyond what was being done in World War II. In this case, what it does, it is actually an anticoagulant that will stop it from bleeding as profusely as it does. You could put all of these into a customized kit, buy one off the shelf, off the rack. The world is your apple as far as what you're going to do to make this happen. I also recommend that you have a water purification device in your vehicle at your home. We keep expeditionary water filters here at the house. These, of course, will go in your go bag. when it comes to the food items that you would put in there. I always recommend freeze-dried foods. Mountain House is terrific for that. Maybe you can find a way to get them cheaper by buying in larger quantities, things like that. And there's also this terrific thing. I don't know if I mentioned this or not in the previous one, but it bears mentioning again. America distributes meals ready to eat that are called humanitarian rations that are in a pinkish bag that are 24-hour rations that are vegetarian. There's no meat products in them. So that they can put these on a pallet, bounce them out of a C-130 over conflict areas where there are civilians, so civilians have rations available to them. There are 2021, 2022 ration sets of 10 of these in a box, and I purchased them for as low as $30 for 10 of them. So what I've done, since these are 24-hour rations, is I bought 6 cases, which means that both my wife and I can use these for the first 30 days in extremis if we have to, either in the, and I put some in the car, but I don't keep them in the car. I keep them in my HVAC provisioned house. I don't keep them in the garage. I keep them in a place where they're not going to be subject to the humidity or temperature fluxes and variations that would affect food items in a negative way. So I've got 6 of those cases, 10 each, 60, which means that I have enough for my wife and I in extraordinary circumstances where we can take care of ourselves. You can augment that with meat products as you wish. Go to Costco or a big box store and get canned chicken, canned beef, whatever the case may be. Maybe even the freeze-dried stuff to augment this. But I think this is a terrific way for those of you especially who are on a budget to have a bulletproof means of having rations available to you, even if you're rather po' or with the po's, as it were. So go bags themselves. I love Maxpedition and VanQuest, but if you go to an Army Surplus store, you can find every manner of cheaper, albeit used, stuff where any bag that you, the bag size you want, everything from a canvas tool bag to a full-on ruck and everything in between that you would need to put all of this stuff in, which of course would include changes of clothes. I talked to you about ammo loadouts and magazine loadouts last episode that one could keep in your car or keep in your house. The whole idea of a go bag in your house or in your car is that you have something that has been packed with everything that you find necessary that you can sling on your back and, you know, get in your leather personnel carriers and go wherever you have to go with it and have the means to survive better than you would with nothing at all. So that covers a lot of the practical aspects of discrete and unique items that one would get to survive this coming apocalyptic event that I think is much more of a when than an if that I regret to say. And now, this is going to seem a bit banal, but I think it's important, and that's that, are you maintaining your house's ability to function in the way that it should, even if you don't have access to a power grid? For instance, we have a genset, and we have a dedicated genset plug-in that we installed for our 20-amp box. Maybe some of you rural folk have a 40-amp box, which gives you even more opportunities to make that happen. Are you maintaining your cars in a fashion in which they are reliable? Are you making sure to look at things as far as preventative maintenance and all of that to make sure that it's going to do exactly what you need it to do? For instance, the other day here in Florida, we had flooding in an area very close to my house, and I was trying to get home from the gym. And when I did, I could not take my usual route. I drive a Highlander, but I don't drive a four-wheel drive Highlander. So I wanted to avoid getting in the drink, as it were, and being stuck in a waterbound emergency with my vehicle. Don't want to do that at all. But again, I was prepared, and I had what I needed. As a matter of fact, I keep extra orange vests in my car for the very reason when I came to an intersection. There was a young gentleman who was heroically directing traffic because there were cops down the road who were otherwise occupied, and he was signaling to everybody, don't go down this road, and I handed him, he was dressed in dark clothing, and dusk was coming. So I handed him an orange vest, which is, to me, disposable. He put that on, and for me, I felt good that I could do this for him, but it also makes it so that nobody's going to turn him into an additional casualty in this flooding event. So I guess you can use this. I always try to say when you're a preparedness person, what you're trying to do is you're trying to achieve a level of contingency planning that usually is above and beyond what most normal humans do. But all you're doing is you're simply saying, what are those things that I need to do to make sure that I can, in my case, as a man, take care of my family and make sure that we make it through this and come out on top. Now, I've talked about all these material things. A lot of this involves training. I mentioned that my son goes to a Stop the Bleed course, probably on twice a year, once a year on occasion. I would urge you guys to find that out. Go to first aid courses, go to CPR courses, and look at all of the training that's available as far as weapons handling. There are wilderness medicine courses available out there that are really terrific. All this kind of training is out there for you to leverage and take advantage of. And who knows, you may meet people that you wouldn't have met before and find new friends and acquaintances and such. So I think that there are a lot of positives to taking the time to being very forward-thinking about looking around and looking at the world and looking at the very dim future that all of us, either if we're reality-based, like I think I and my listeners are, or even those who believe in unicorn farts and rainbows, if you're not ready for what's going to happen, even if you don't think it's inevitable, you're going to be the poorer for it when it happens and you're not ready because you're not fulfilling your obligation to protect yourself or, to a greater extent, protecting those that you love. So moving on to other things, I have some recommended reading in the coming bad times. I recently got three books, and I'll put these in the book notes that I think you'll find amusing. And of course, your mileage may vary, but these are simply for speculation and entertainment. Ian Jones wrote an interesting book called Malice Aforethought, A History of Booby Traps from World War I to Vietnam. And then Osprey Military Publications, who published these small, thin, 64-page tomes with lots of color illustrations. And I've been reading these since I've been a kid. I got both the ones by Gordon L. Rotman, what an unfortunate name, World War II Axis Booby Traps and Sabotage Tactics, accompanied by World War II Allied Sabotage Devices and Booby Traps. Now, am I recommending these books so that you can do this yourself? That's up to you. That's not my decision to take. Nor am I in your headspace and timing to determine what you do with your moral and actionable agency. The reason I'm drawing these books to your attention is because I think that part of this when, not if, apocalyptic event that is going to occur where we will have cells of men, some women possibly, aided by auxiliaries with weapons who are going to prey on American civilians and maybe even cops, and maybe if they break into a military complex or revetment, military folks. But for the most part, I want you to be aware of what they may be doing as far as booby traps and these kind of things, because you have to be aware of the kind of things that they're going to do that will injure you, maim you, kill you. So if you wish to take that in another direction, because I've recommended those books, that's on you, not me. The reason I'm drawing those books to your attention is to draw to your attention the full quiver of arms and mischief that these interlocutors of violence, when these cellular structures launch one day in the near, I hope, far future, that you'll have an idea of what their martial or terroristic imagination may envision, and maybe you'll be able to do your homework and figure out, oh, maybe I shouldn't go there, or maybe that's not what it appears to be. So that's why I made those recommendations. Of course, we also see with the mischief that's going on in the United Kingdom with the election of Reichsminister Keir Starmer. It turns out that the German invasion plans for England under Operation Sea Lion were to be launched and abandoned in 1940, took a mere 85 years to actually come to fruition, and they were done by an indigenous English political enclave instead of a foreign interloper like Germany at the time in World War II. That will also be instructive for all of you who are conflict observers and observers of martial exploits planet-wide, both historical, contemporary, and in a futurist perspective, trying to determine what's going to happen, that when you look at what is going on in the United Kingdom, which would be Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and England proper, that we are seeing maybe a canary in the coal mine over there, where despite what they say, there is two-tiered policing. Despite what they say in the island of Eyre, E-I-R-E, which is the island that gained its independence from the UK in 1922, that there are some very interesting immigration squabbles and civil war indicators and warnings that are starting to emerge. I would suggest the same thing is happening not only in England, not only in Ireland proper, but also across the entire continent of Europe. Now, is this a result of immigration policies? Is this a result of what I've talked about with regional conflict complexes, in which when you have larger wars, it opens up the framework and blows oxygen on the embers of long simmering conflicts that could blow up into civil wars, intramural wars, interstate wars, as a result of the larger war uncorking all of these miscellaneous legitimacy questions, narrative questions, and guerrilla questions that emerge from this, in which these conflict complexes become more complex and cause those chaos avalanches that I am so fond of. Remember, I repeat again, all wars are won by the least incompetent forces, and this is historical fact. And if one goes back 3,000 years into recorded historical context and observation of conflicts both east and west, that tends to be the case. So I think I've satisfied the gamut of questions that listeners and readers brought to my attention after the issuance of episode 049 on my Storming America addendum, as it were, for TTP and Remaining Free, and what you need to do left of bang and before this happens to better prepare yourself and position yourself for success, which in this case means that you're still air-breathing and vertical once this unpleasantness comes. I wanted to bring something else to your attention. I try to remain out of the contemporaneous political conflicts and saying, you know, you should vote for this, or you won't hear that at this podcast. But nonetheless, I do think that civilizational chaos, as a result of what I've talked about in Storming America, as a result of the chaos avalanche that we see across the fruited plain, and as a result of an education system and a media system that simply doesn't appreciate critical thinking, it doesn't appreciate reflection, it doesn't appreciate contemplation, it doesn't make heroes out of stoic folk, it doesn't take the time to look at the standards of civilizational conduct and construct and really take into account, how did we get here? Why are we where we're at? You've heard me say time and again that I'm very fond as a, I wouldn't say I'm a practicing, but I'm very enchanted by the neo-Victorian or even the Victorian era when I select parts of it for the gentlemanly and scholarly nature of some of the things that occurred. It doesn't mean that the whole wolf and wharf of what comprised Victorian civilization was something that we should replicate today. That would certainly not be the case. But nonetheless, there are a lot of things that one can draw from that particular civilization, and you're hearing this from a reluctant Anglophile, that would make our lives better now, make the lives of our children and grandchildren better now. If any of you have read a book by Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell called Lucifer's Hammer about a comet hitting Earth, written in the 1980s, I think I've read it 3 or 4 times, really enjoyed it. I love both of those authors. As a matter of fact, I just revisited Niven and Purnell's Beowulf series, which is absolutely fantastic, which is Legacy of Heorot and Beowulf's Children, a science fiction story about the first, in this case, National Geographic expedition by humans off-world to settle a new planet, in this case, part of the planet, and the chaos avalanches that inform themselves in this book that make it so fun. So in there, there's something called the Dan Forrester Memorial Library. And Dan Forrester was not a gunman. He was not a guy who was super capable. He was a bit obese, but he said, man, what am I scratching his chin? He said, in the event, in the aftermath of the apocalypse, if I survive, what can I bring to the table that will get me through the gate? And by the way, this riffs off of a friend of mine in real life who was going to use this very notion himself. He has since passed on. Now, among those books, and I'm going to put in the show notes a link to a website that has the complete categorization and listing of all of these books, and I'm certain that all of you can add books to these, and I would appreciate feedback on this if that were the case. What I would recommend as an addendum to the Dan Forrester Memorial Library is the 1991 Encyclopedia Britannica. Get that in books and keep it at home. The 54-volume, not the later 60-volume, Great Books of the Western World, which were edited by Clifton Fadiman and Mortimer Adler. You've heard me recommend Adler's book, How to Read a Book, which I recommend to everybody. Recommend the entire Foxfire set. I think that's volumes 1 through 2 with 2 addendum volumes for the 40th and 45th anniversary. And there's probably other books out there, but have those hardbound books, or, and this is either paper or hardback, but have the actual physical books. A complete 4-volume edition of How Things Work, which I think came out in the 60s and 70s. I think it's still invaluable. For me, Liberty Fund books, Liberty Press, love those books. I have a considerable library of them. Every Liberty Fund book you can find in book form, I'd get those. I think that's a good start. Whatever recommendations you may have as listeners and readers, I'd love to hear from you. Either at cgpodcast@pm.me, that is cgpodcast@pm.me, or my Substack for Chasing Ghosts, where we can have conversations once I post these podcast episodes on there. There is a convenient comment section, which was one of the real attractions of starting the Substack in the first place, was so that I could have that conversation. And then I also wanted to say, please go to the blog where I'm consistently, and I think in an informed and gentlemanly fashion, taking a chainsaw and a wrecking ball to the current U.S. mostly, but also Western military complex and all the wrong things they're doing to be prepared not only for a new instantiation of a third world or developing world conflict like in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Syria, but the near peer and peer competition, which could turn into a conventional conflict in the coming decade or decades, and how the U.S. military and the West and NATO by extension are wholly unprepared for it in detail, in depth, and width. And I also urge you to go to Libertarian Institute, where I am the Smedley D. Butler Fellow for Military Affairs, and look at my blog postings of 4 or 5 times a week on the blog there, where I talk about these very things. So, with that, I thank you for your solicitude, your listenership. I would urge you all to please recommend other listeners who haven't taken part in the podcast, and let them know you like it. If you get a chance to review me on the podcast vendors that you employ, I would be obliged if you did so. and my heartfelt thanks to all of my listeners. Here we are at episode 050. I'm hoping eventually we get to 0500, but who knows? We'll see what the future portends. Or maybe I will have assumed room temperature by that time. So again, thank you. And this is Bill out.